So the future of storytelling is to keep telling the story, to be in community with each other, to tell it face to face like you and I are doing in some ways. And it is important as we become a surveillance state that we continue to be in community with each other, to be in places with each other that we know we can protect each other. And when I protect you, I protect myself. This is the revolution and we need to keep doing.
Welcome back, Slow Divers. How are you doing today? How are your loved ones doing? Did you take a minute to express gratitude for them today? Well, good. I'm glad. I'm your host, Farida Rafiq, joined by my producer, Drew Francois. And today we are honored to be joined by Farah Fazel, a 9-time Emmy Award-winning documentary producer and director and a former war correspondent whose storytelling explores what it means to be human, to feel, to connect, and to be transformed. Farah's journey has taken her from the front lines of war to refugee camps, from Hollywood film sets to intimate living rooms, always chasing truth and shining a light into people and places too often unseen. Her work has been featured on major platforms including Hulu, Oxygen, A&E, Lifetime, and Peacock. And she's known for crafting purpose-driven, character-rich narratives that transcend borders, evoke empathy, and reveal our shared humanity. With a background that spans investigative journalism, unscripted television, and documentary film, Farah blends a precision of reporting with the emotional depth of cinematic storytelling. Her work is raw, revealing, and rooted in connection, culture, and change, often centered on those living at the edge of courage, creativity, and the quiet revolution of compassion. Storytelling for Farah is a calling, one that reminds us the power of a story can be the power of change. Today, we dive into her extraordinary path from the war zones of Syria and the refugee camps of Africa to the editing rooms of Los Angeles and into the heart of what drives her work, her purpose, and her unshakable belief in the power of truth. Welcome, Farah.
Hello, Farida. And hello, Slow Divers. I'm so happy to be in your community with you today.
Oh my gosh. And we are so happy you're here, Farah. Okay. We'll start off with our icebreakers. If you were a bird, what bird would you be?
I think I might be a peacock. I live near the Hollywood Cemetery and my neighbors are the peacocks. And they are a magnificent specimen of being. They always know their beauty. And I suppose in these moments, they are also pretty friendly. So maybe all peacocks are not domesticated, but my neighbors, the peacocks, are pretty friendly.
Nice. Yes. Peacocks are gorgeous. Stunning. What is one thing that's bringing you joy this week?
A community of creatives that I had the absolute privilege to be a part of a few days ago. We came together really to understand, to talk to each other, to connect, to figure out how we are going to use our craft, our gift in the service of this moment. And it gave me immense amounts of joy to be able to actually be in community with. I was on a set for many hours all weekend long. So really, we were doing creative work and I was doing creative work with other directors. And then I went to the salon that I helped curate. And so I was in a different space with a lot of other creatives who gave me immense amounts of heart-filling joy that we are going to use our craft here to tell the stories of this moment.
Yes, absolutely. Love my creative people. We're a good bunch of people.
We are. We are always thinking. We're always using humor in the service because humor is a superpower. To be able to mock the fascists is a superpower. So to be able to be in community with people who are always thinking that way is.
Yeah, and you're
learning always.
You need a place to recharge, right? Like from doing all this important work. Who is someone who has quietly inspired you, but might not even know it?
I am so often inspired by the abolitionists who went way before us. I remember reading a story of around slavery time, and enslaved people were scattered on all of these places. And the abolitionists decided that they needed to know that there was a system that they could escape this. It was called the Underground Railroad. So they began actually writing these newspapers, these letters, and trying to get it to all of the people in places where they were being enslaved to let them know that there was a way out. And I found, so I will never know them and they will never know us because it was a different generation. But I'm so inspired by the abolitionists of the past. And actually, we have had abolitionists in every period of revolution, including now, including Toni Morrison, who left us, including Maya Angelou, who left us. You know, Frederick Douglass, there are so many. There's a friend of mine who was telling me about a film that she's working on that she got an IP of a woman who was actually changed the dynamic of this world. And very few people know who she is. She was a Jawaharlal Nehru's sister.
Okay.
And she was actually the first woman who was the president of the UN, first brown woman who was the president of the UN, and her work literally changing the dynamic of human rights, of storytelling, of lifting up communities has kind of been erased. And I think these are the people from whom I learn about how we show up in this moment of revolution, and that I think I will never be able to tell, obviously, because they went before us. But I feel their spirit. These two people do know that I felt this way about them. But my parents were humanity's antidote to hate. They were the bastions of compassion. And I think that all of them inform who I am.
True. That's beautiful. Farah, one last icebreaker question. What is a favorite family tradition or recipe that you most cherish?
My mother used to make, so my parents were born in Africa. My grandparents were born in India and they left to immigrate to Africa. So there is a whole actually cuisine, as most people, brown people like me will know, that mixes sort of Indian and African cuisine. And my mother would make it was called kukupaka, which means really coconut curry with chicken. I'm a vegetarian. I have adapted that to you know, how I eat. But the instrumental recipe of a coconut curry with potatoes and eggs and this deep yellow, beautiful, rich curry sauce. I remember growing up with it. She always made it. And honestly, she made it because everybody loved it. Everybody in families loved it. Everybody asked her to make it. And so I make it now for special occasions. And it reminds me of my mother's, you know, her hands on this cooking always tasted better. So to me, this kukupaka and I guess my adaptation of that beautiful coconut curry is something that I love.
That sounds so delicious. So do you eat it but with rice or bread, or how do you accompany the curry?
A couple of ways. You can eat it with rice. You can eat it with naan. But we always used to eat it with makate mimina, it was called an African word, which was like the sweet bread. And it was, you know, a little kick, a little coconut curry with a kick and some sweet bread. Man,
nice.
Good times.
Wow. I love that. And I love that. Yes. I'm going to have to try that one day, Farah, because that sounds delicious.
Absolutely.
Especially
well, it is.
Coconut base. I love stuff with coconut in it, right?
How could you not, really?
It's all good. It's all good. All right. Well, let's start with, Farah, your path has taken you from reporting in war zones to directing powerful documentaries and unscripted series. What first drew you into storytelling, and how did that early spark evolve into this like fearless, purpose-driven work that you're doing now?
That's a great start. I was 7 years old sitting on my uncle's couch in London, and we were watching the BBC. And I watched on the TV was a reporter who was talking to a child who at that time was my age. He was seven. And the reporter, they looked like they were in a war zone, like something had happened behind them. And I heard this little boy say that he was all alone in the world. And he didn't know what to do because his whole entire family had been killed in this bomb blast. And I remember thinking in that moment, I can't imagine that he doesn't have parents anymore. He's all alone in the world. And it was this deep sense of affectation that I had that I couldn't stop thinking about. And I told my uncle, "Uncle, when you go to work, like, you need to tell everybody about this boy. I didn't know why I didn't know what that would accomplish in the grand scheme of things. I just needed everybody to know there was this little boy in the world who had lost his parents. And what could we do? How could we be family to him? And then I went to school. I was at boarding school, and I went and told all my friends at school. And I think it was the beginning and the seminal moment of storytelling. I didn't know that's what it was called. I didn't understand that that's how we carried story. But I just knew intuitively that that's what I needed to do and that's what I must do. And it never left me, that sense of carrying story, of telling story, of being able to be present in story and to feel somebody's story. I always know that there's a feeling that I had when people would tell me their stories. When he told us his stories, and we're sitting on the other end of the television. So I was affected by it, and I remember it creating a mark in my being. And I remember that's what I knew that that's something that I needed to do. And so all throughout growing up and as a teenager, the funny story about storytelling is when I was a teenager, I was in Canada, and I really felt like nobody was telling, I would look at the TV and nobody was telling stories about kids like me. Nobody cared. I didn't see myself on television. And I thought, I mean, I should, you know, they have this like public access. I think I should like come up with a show for kids like me, and then I should go to public access. So I did. And I said, hey, hi, my name is Farah, and I want to do a show. And they said, how old are you? And I said, oh, well, I'm 16. And I have this proposal for a show. And they said, yeah, like, we don't do that. Shouldn't you be in school? I said, well, I was in school and I I'm still going to school, but I also can do this. And they said, yeah, we don't do that. So I said, oh, actually, yeah, you do, because I saw that you are public access and I'm the public and I need access. Honestly, I think that at some point they just needed to get rid of me. And they said, okay, fine, come in. And eventually they assigned me a producer and we did this little show. And I think my mother was the only person who watched, but whatever. It was my need to use this medium that I found powerful from the very beginning as a 7-year-old to try to figure out how to tell story, to tell my story, to tell other people's story.
That is incredible. You knew your calling very early on, and you've just like, you took the initiative and made it happen. And that's really great that you knew so young. This is what got activated in you when you saw another kid speaking, sharing their story. I love that, because it makes sense, right? Like, we always know it's in us, and you're embodying your purpose, which is so wonderful. You lived and worked across continents, from Africa, London, Canada, and US. How have your global roots and early experiences shaped you as a producer and director?
Completely. I have a different lens into the world as a producer and a director, as an interviewer, as a journalist. I spent one of my very, very favorite things to do, even when it is with extremely traumatized people, is to be in conversation with them. For me, an interview is not an interview. It's a conversation, and it requires two of us. The ability to build trust quickly requires that people have to trust me, and that they understand that their story is safe with me in my hands, and that actually I reciprocate with story. So often I think interviewers think, oh, well, I'll just ask you all the questions, and it's, you know, then you answer the question. In my world, storytelling requires a trust that we will share with each other. And I think when we share with people understand that we are instrumentally also sharing a piece of ourselves, which allows them to share more, the most deepest thing that they have. And so I have been shaped by growing up as a brown girl in Africa. I was born in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam. I went to school in London and Canada, and I've lived in the US. I've lived in Florida, Montana, Missouri, Nebraska, Texas, Minnesota, California. All of those places have informed, those are different communities. They have helped shape me, shape the way I see the world. I've worked across countries. So I went as a journalist to Pakistan, and I remember going to the Wagah border between Pakistan and India, and it's these two countries in one moment of time open these borders and become one. For one moment a day, every day, the Wagah border opens, and for one moment of time, these two countries who have been enemies sometimes and sometimes friends and very much enemies become these one people. And it really helped me understand the idea of borders and how borders have been used to keep us apart and to separate us. And are they necessary? Why are they necessary?
Yeah.
My time in Syria was absolutely instrumental for me. So I was there 2018-19 during the hottest year of the war. And there was a lot of suffering. There was a lot of blood. There was a lot of bomb blasts. There was a lot of murder. And there was a lot of killing of children. There was a lot of chemical attacks. Syrians helped me understand the idea of hope in a really instrumental way. They had been living under a brutal, brutal, cruel dictatorship for 50 years. They had torture chambers designed inside their country, designed to torture in the most horrific ways that you could think of to torture a body, the dictator Bashar al-Assad did to Syrians.
Yeah.
And people would always tell me that they knew that there was hope of another day, that there would be another day when they could see a world without this kind of authoritarianism and cruelty and dictatorship. They felt hope that that day would arrive. And it has now in these days, you know, that Bashar al-Assad is no longer in power. And so I think that the Syrians allowed me to understand something really instrumental about our humanity.
Farah, when you were, like you said, building trust with the people that you're listening to their stories and sharing your stories, what are some examples of how you build trust and how do you navigate like high conflict in environments, especially in care with yourself, self-care for yourself in that situation, and also being mindful of who you're interviewing for us who've never reported from a war zone, but we see these atrocities and I'm always like, how courageous are these doctors, these reporters, these journalists in those high conflict war zone areas witnessing these atrocities and still showing up and being strong? And I just wonder, like, how do you navigate that space when you're there?
It begins before you get there.
Yeah.
With the recognition of what you're doing and where you're going and what your purpose and your mission is. Mm-hmm. I needed to go to Syria. I knew that people were leaving. Storytellers were leaving Syria. And so the idea of going to a war zone, to that particular war zone, mattered because I felt that I could tell the story of the people whose voices we might not hear. And so it was really purposeful. I knew and accepted the finiteness of my life. In all the war zones that I've been, I would always tell my brother that even if I didn't come back, you should know that I went to do something that felt deeply purposeful and mission-oriented. And this idea of telling story was absolutely important to me. And I'll see you on the other end. So I felt like, you know, the idea that I was committed. And listen, there are many, many, many more brave people than me. A lot of the people from Doctors Without Borders who are working in war zones all around the world, who see the most horrific things every day and choose to keep showing up to do this incredibly important work of caregiving and caretaking and healing and helping heal wounds in the way that they can. And sometimes they cannot save lives, but they show up always to try to fulfill their, you know, their mission. And so I felt like story was that, you know, that thing for me, that I could, this is something that I could do. I could use what I knew and what I have learned about storytelling to help people whose voices would not. So how do you arrive in a war zone? I honor the land that belongs to the people who live there. I try to understand their culture. I try to understand how they live and work and breathe and walk through this land that is theirs. And I honor that. It's really difficult when you have bombs dropping everywhere, you have bombs exploding everywhere, to not understand your finiteness, not understand your mortality. And it is in these moments, I'm not an interviewer, I'm not a reporter, I'm a human being to other people. And I think when you are a human being and you show up that way, even in war zones, it allows you to create trust and solidarity with the people with whom I needed to understand, who I'm asking under these really horrific conditions for them to tell me their story. Yeah. And so I arrive with humbleness and this deep honor of the idea that I know their story is precious and that I will treat it that way and that I am standing with them in solidarity as we walk through these hard moments together.
Thank you for saying that, Farah, in solidarity with them. Because yes, it is a very sacred thing for someone to be so vulnerable and share that with someone and not, because there have been instances with some journalists and some people where people have been, it feels extractive and exploitive. So the fact that you said that, you used the word in solidarity that, yeah, we're this global family and they're trusting you with this. How does the emotional weight of the people you interview, the participants in your documentaries, how does that stay with you? And how do you deal with it after you come back from a war zone or a project that really moved you? Because I imagine it is probably heavy work. You know, we're thinking, feeling human beings, and especially someone like yourself who was so called at such an early age to do this heavy work. Like, how do you kind of deal with it afterwards? How do you carry these stories way after the project or the assignment or the film is done?
Thank you for the question. And it comes out of so much care. So I really appreciate that. It is difficult to know. In war zones, I left people. For a while, I kept in touch. And when they no longer were able to be in touch, I know that either they were not alive anymore or that they couldn't be in touch anymore. And it is a really, I consider it an honor that I had the privilege of, for a moment in time, for knowing these human beings. And it has an effect. I had PTSD after I came back from war zones. And it required that I address that for myself. I needed therapy. I went to be able to get caretaking for myself, because until I could really find healing and find a place to make peace with what I had seen and what I had heard, I couldn't literally create the capacity to keep hearing other people's stories, to keep walking into other spaces where people would tell me their traumatized story. I did a show last year on Hulu called How I Escaped My Cult. Really, it was a story about how these survivors overcame extraordinary circumstances, incredible odds to leave sometimes their family members, everything that they had known, and walk out of this authoritarian structure, which was the only world that they knew. And they were among the most traumatized people that I had ever met. And they, for hours and hours, relive their lives to tell me their story. Without having dealt with my trauma from war zones, I never would have been able to actually create all the space that they deserve from me to listen and to understand and to be with them as they tell me these stories. So I think it was really important to do the work to prepare myself continually for the next batch of storytellers with whom I'm in, privileged to be in. So caretaking is huge. Caregiving to myself is huge. And I find that service is really feels meaningful. To be able to be of service when I have come to an understanding of myself, to share that with other people, because in this moment of fascism and authoritarianism in this country, there is hurt and constant trauma every day. It is meant to separate us. It is meant to create isolation. And if we don't deal with our own trauma, we can't actually step into this moment and be in community with other people. So being able to take care of the trauma that I have had has been instrumental in continuing to step into other areas.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I think that's a great reminder for all of us, whether or not we have reported or worked in high conflict or war zones, because I think if we're healed ourselves, we show up better and healed for our community, you know, in general, right? Like we clean our side of the road first and be like, oh, what are things I need to work on so I can show up better for everybody else?
A friend of mine, yes. Just real quickly, it's just a really quick story. My friend Ruba, who's a Palestinian. Mm-hmm. I remember her saying always, people, deal with your unhealed trauma. Deal with it. Because until you can deal with that, you cannot hear me. You cannot step in with me. You cannot understand my story. And I think it was really persuasive as a Palestinian woman who has lived through apartheid and occupation and genocide, whose parents still live there. The idea that she could understand other people's unhealed trauma is a deterrent, is I think really
important. Yeah, in on the power of community, and we mentioned so much of like what it is to be in community in times of conflict. How have you seen stories bridge divides, or have you seen your work or other fellow colleagues' work in storytelling bridge divides or bring more understanding to those areas that, like you said, people are so wanting to isolate or separate? And you saw more unity. Are there any examples that come to your mind of recently?
Yes, I went to Africa, to Kenya. At the time, it was the biggest refugee camp in the world. It was called Dadaab. Mm-hmm. The reason why I went there was to find a three-year-old. I was living at the time in Minnesota, and I met her parents. And they told me that they had to leave their baby in a refugee camp in Dadaab, because the government wouldn't allow them to bring their baby, days old baby, when they got refugee status to the United States. And the reason why the government wouldn't let them bring this little baby, her name is Anfa, is because the government said that Anfa couldn't go through extreme vetting. She couldn't tell them that she wasn't a terrorist. 1% of all refugees get refugee status in mm-hmm. the U.S. And so for them to have this moment when they could actually have freedom and what they considered to be the country that would allow them to be free here in America at the time in 2017 and 18 was a really big deal. So how could they say no? They had two other children who were really sick, and they thought, we will come and then we will bring our baby, days old. They left their days-old baby in a refugee camp. When I met them, it had been 3.5 years already that they had been trying to get her here. So I went to find her, to tell her story. And we did tell her story. Finding Anfa was like finding a needle in a haystack, because there were 500,000 people in this refugee camp, and we didn't know exactly where she was. So we really, in some ways, by the grace of God, go I. Like, we were just trying to find where in the world would she be. We did find her, and she was the sassiest 3.5-year-old I've ever met. And she gave me this lens into survival and resilience. And at 3.5, living in a refugee camp, she knew her power. We came back from that trip and we told her story. I will say I've gotten death threats all throughout my career, from the US-Mexico border to the other border. I got the most amount of death threats when I did Anfa's story. To me, it was a story of child separation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To the people who saw it differently, it was America, you know, giving a free pass to immigrants. Telling her story was absolutely crucial, because what ended up happening 7.5 months to the day that I met Anfa in that refugee camp in Kenya, Anfa Abdullahi, because of the work that, because of telling her story, because it got to different places, it allowed her story to live in people's hearts and motivated people. Anfa Abdullahi got on a plane in Nairobi, went through Amsterdam and Chicago. And for the first time in her 3.5 years, she was united at Minneapolis International Airport with her parents for the first time in 3.5 years. I think of myself as a storyteller, and I was really literally just a story. We are not just storytellers. We are absolutely storytellers. But if I never had any other experience in my life, if that was the last thing I ever did in my world, it felt absolutely life crucial to see a child reunite with her parents. And she is now, she's almost a preteen living in America and another American kid who is with her parents. And I think it changed my life. That transformed me deeply.
First of all, Farah, that is so beautiful that I'm like trying to hold back my tears here because I'm not a parent, but I can imagine the pain the parents must have felt to be separated from their child. And there's so many families across the world right now, not just in Kenya, that are separated with their children due to political reasons, due to conflict, and that you were, quote, able to facilitate a reunification for a family is just such beautiful work. And I mean, I'm really, really happy that you're sharing this story. And that is the power of storytelling. I mean, right there, like a clear present example that it can. It takes one person. You can probably help one family, but this is the, like, when people are like, oh, why should we fund filmmakers? Why should we support art projects or storytelling? This is exactly why. It's not necessarily the person. Like, I sometimes feel like we have, especially if we have the passion and the calling and the purpose behind it, we are just a part of the system to bring people together in this global community. And we're just doing our part as stewards of this global community. And if people saw that as more of why it's so important to support our journalists, our press, our storytellers, even our first responders and humanitarian people, because they're also engaging in important storytelling as well. They're day-to-day archiving these experiences that we're so removed from, but they're then coming back to the States and sharing their experiences. Otherwise, we would not have known if they weren't the ones there. So thank you for doing that. And that's a true testament of how important storytelling is.
We have real life examples of that in the last 2 years in the genocide in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Our brothers and sisters who are journalists in Gaza helped us see this story, helped us see their lives, helped us understand this genocide in instrumental ways. Without them, we would not have known the story of Gaza as we did. Mm-hmm. They are my heroes.
Yeah.
They have affected all of us. They have allowed us, at great cost to themselves, to see what was happening in Gaza, to know the stories of the mothers, fathers, children's children, of the grandparents, of this land that they love, of the oppression that they have suffered through for so many years. And I think that for us to actually be able to honor these storytellers and the price that they have paid, I don't know that we will. It is immeasurable that we will never be able to completely be as grateful as we want to. Without them, they have shifted the world. Mm-hmm. We are in a different place now than we were 2 years ago. We understand Palestine. We understand genocide, and we understand it through the storytellers who were killed along the way and who brought us these stories the last 2 years.
Yes, definitely. Storytelling as resistance. I mean, as I see it personally.
I agree.
Farah, before we move on to this, I want to get into the story of the Palestinian elder with you. But what are your thoughts about the genocide being, I guess the word around the vernacular that is being used is live streamed on social media? How do you think that's impacted, like, the culture of Americans? And do you see that as a good, bad thing? Well, not good or bad thing, but like, what kind of war are we fighting with this social media thing, with the war of information? Like, for example, in context for me, and maybe I'm not being as articulate as I should be to convey this. It's on one end, we're seeing this, so we can't deny it. It's in front of us. And then it's also kind of like surreal that then it's on social media and then on a political spectrum, we're so detached from it. And we go on, like, I feel this enormous guilt. Like once you're logged off, you still know this is happening. It still exists. And there's so many other atrocities and genocides and conflicts that we don't see this close in front So how do you reconcile those feelings? I don't even know if this makes sense as a question, but this is something I'm trying to process myself. Like in like a couple of years ago, I would not have seen any of this. And the fact that I've seen so much horrific bloodshed and amputees and children in distress carrying food and just the amount of footage, it's unreal to me. It's this dystopian nightmare, but then it's real at the same time. I don't know. How do you reconcile those feelings, and how do you think, is it being used the right way? Because, you know, social media, it's strange. It seems almost detached from our reality, but at the same time, it's real. I'm probably very confused.
Well, the reason why I think we struggle to really define it is because it's so complicated. The dehumanization of Palestinians has been going on for decades. They used every bit of power they had to help us see them, to help us see their dehumanization. That required them being able to use every avenue they had to allow us to see that. And so in so many ways, I have to tell you that watching a genocide live stream for 2 years, I know it has completely changed me. I cannot imagine as human beings that it does not change us in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Some of that has been really difficult to deal with. We have felt numb. And the way maybe that has manifested is we've had less empathy for people because it has stretched really the fibers of our capacity.
Hmm.
And so we struggle to continue in this ever more violent extension of seeing more violent things and more violent things and experiencing violence for ourselves. Our bodies are not, this is not meant for us. This is not how this is way too much for human beings to deal with. And so, yes, there is that complicated piece, right? We as human beings are not programmed to see and understand and accept this much violence. And we as human beings, I as a human being, have a responsibility to the people who are trying to tell me their story in every way that they can for me to honor and for me not to look away.
Yeah.
It is really complicated because it has changed inside our DNA of what we are able to see and not see. And I cannot look away because I see it as my honoring somebody mm-hmm. telling me that. And
yeah.
So, the way that they have to do that is through my social media feed. That's how I will tell you this, that seeing what was happening in Gaza, I knew I couldn't get there. My instinct was to go to Gaza because I wanted to tell that story along with the people, the brave, courageous journalists who were telling it. That wasn't an option. And so I went to Palestine. My friend whose parents live in Jerusalem, I knew that I had to go, and I knew that could be an opportunity for me. So I needed to go on a personal odyssey, and I needed to go on a storytelling odyssey. And so a year ago, I went to Palestine. I went to Jerusalem, and for several days, I walked through the world with my Palestinian friend, and I got to see what it was like for her as a Palestinian woman walking around in Israel-Palestine. It was stark. You know, in so many ways, I can be mistaken because of my color of my skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced that dehumanization that she has suffered for all of her many years on this earth. What that was like to live like that. I also went to the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
I convinced some Israeli peace activists who are called the Protective Presence people, who go to Palestinian villages and stand in resistance against the settlers and the IDF with the Palestinians. And they took me to a village that has been around for at least 900 years. And I met a woman whom I called Siti Tamem. Siti means grandmother, and her name was Tamem. And Siti Tamem told me that she was living through her second Nakba, her second genocide. And she said many decades ago, she said she was living in Tantura. Tantura was a village in Israel. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a documentary that you can find about what happened in Tantura during that first genocide of Palestinians during the time the state of Israel was born. She said to me, the occupation army came and they killed the men and they raped the women and killed the children and they raped some of the children and she played dead. And she was able to survive.
Mm.
And she was able to come to Umm Safa, to this piece of land that her family had. And that is where I met her a year ago. And when I met her a year ago, she said to me, the occupation army came 2 weeks ago and they destroyed my land. And she was pretty, I'd say she was pretty clinical when she was telling me, the occupation army came and destroyed all of my land. But then she became very, very emotional and she said, Habibti, they murdered my sage. They murdered my sage, which to her was a symbol of her resilience. It was a symbol of the land. It was a symbol of her people. And it was a sustainability that Palestinians make sage tea with sage that she grew on her land. And it's in that moment she became very emotional. And she said to all of us, 25 peace activists and I, to come to her little house. And we did. It was about that big. And she went inside and she came out with a tray of little cups of sage tea. And she told us that the day before, she said that the occupation army came, the IDF, she said that she had picked a bundle of sage and she wanted to make that sage tea for us. And that's what she did. For these 26 strangers that she didn't really know, 25 of whom were Israelis, who for her, you know, it was an act of complete and utter compassion. And when I thought she couldn't be any more compassionate, she did the most compassionate thing that she could do. And she said, I have this little bit of sage left, which was to her the most precious thing of her life and her land. And that one little bundle of sage she gave to us to take with us. I have it in my cupboard and I look at it every day. And it reminds me of Tamem. And I don't know if Siti Tamem is alive or not today, a year later.
Yeah.
But her story and her ability to tell me her story so that I would not forget was absolutely crucial for me. And my friend Aziza, who is the executive director of Newground, helped me understand that Siti Tamem told me her story so that I would not forget, that I, whatever happened to her, that I would keep telling her story so that we could keep humanizing this woman who you know, is almost older than the state of Israel, who had survived through the worst of what her life was and found joy and found compassion and found community with people who she never expected to be in community with, these Israeli peace activists.
Yeah, she really entrusted you with a very important story because here we are, you're sharing it with so many more people.
Thank you for allowing me to tell.
And it exemplifies the humanity in these horrible situations. We're all just human and we all just want to be seen and heard and be acknowledged. And I don't think, so incredible, 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 incredible. What is the peace activist group can you share the group that took?
They come from all parts of Israeli society and essentially they operate under the umbrella of protective presence. And they really see their destiny tied to the destiny of the Palestinians. They can only be free. They can only live with self-determination if their neighbors, the Palestinians, can also be free and can also live in self-determination. And so the idea of liberation for them is tied to the story of the Palestinians.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I know before we leave this, I wish I could stay here for a couple more hours, but I know you're a very busy person and you're doing all these amazing things. I want to make sure I get a chance to speak about your current project, Agents of Change. Could you tell us about Agents of Change?
I'm executive producing this incredible documentary that is, I think, unique, and I really believe deeply in its impact. So I'm working with two former intelligence officers who are first-time directors and filmmakers. Megan and Katie gave me the great honor of being able to really walk through this journey with them. Essentially, it's a story of 10 women of the intelligence community. These are women spies who have been the groundbreakers, the people who have spent all of their lives in the service of this country, protecting this country and allowing us to be safe from outside threats. And women, these women are literally have changed the intelligence community with who they are, a pipeline of bringing other women into the intelligence community. We never get to hear, you know, it's the Hollywood myth of women spies. We have a whole bunch of movies of women spies. Mm-hmm. It's very rarely reflective of the actual experience of a woman spy. And so these 10 very, very brave women told us their stories of not only their work and what it meant to them, what service has meant to them, what democracy has meant to them, what power has looked like to them. And I think what is so important is how they are reframing power. Mm. What could it look like? What does democratic power look like? What does it look like in the hands of women? These women, this is not an easy story for them to tell. They have worked in this administration. They have suffered the wrath of this administration. And they choose to tell their story in this moment. They see it as the greatest act of service. And it is our incredible honor to be able to help them tell their stories. So we're in post-production. We will be taking it on the film festival circuit. And we hope that everywhere we go, every film festival it gets accepted into, that we will be able to create a community of women in that place, in that town, so that actually women can be connected with each other and for each other. And my friends, Megan and Katie, have a company called Iron Butterfly Media. And through the Iron Butterfly Media Foundation is where we'll create these communities, these salons, and the film is a product of the Iron Butterfly Media.
I absolutely love the idea of building community around such an important film and a team of like women-led filmmakers on such an important subject. And it hasn't been done. Agents of Change. We're going to link the trailer in our full episode guide. I had a chance to watch it last night and I was just like, this is great. This is great. And I really can't wait to do the, wait till the film is out. So are you like projected like 2026 you're getting?
Yeah, we are in just actually very, very final stages of color and
nice.
Last bits of post-production. My fellow executive producers actually already applied to Berlinale.
Okay.
We feel this is a story that in this moment of authoritarianism in 40% of the world, it is absolutely crucial that I hope that it can be a selection in international festivals everywhere, because our story here, we are in America, in authoritarianism, in fascism. And I think it's a lens into this country from the outside that I think is really important.
Yes. Absolutely. Agents of Change. Cannot wait till it comes out. We have our final segment before we say goodbye. It's a reflective portion. What do you think the future of storytelling should look like?
You know, I had a conversation with you about my purpose right now to try to create as many salons for creatives as we can. And part of that reason is because I really think as creatives, we need to use our gift of storytelling to tell the stories of what is happening every day to our friends, our neighbors, to people I live in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was ground zero in June. Mm-hmm. One of the salons we recently had was with an undocumented filmmaker who came to tell us that in June, he has been here for 25 years. He came as a boy. And in June, he had to make the really difficult decision of whether he was going to self-deport or he was going to stay. He has always, he found storytelling as his medicine and his impact. And he continued to create, even as an undocumented filmmaker all these years, films about his life and the life of his community, of the undocumented in this city, in this country. He chose to stay. He knows they are coming for him. He knows they might come find him. And he chooses in this moment to use his gift and his art in the service of storytelling so that we can know what it is like, so we can understand why we are no different than him, why our fates are tied together. Fannie Lou Hamer said, no one is free until we are all free. Mm-hmm. I am not free until my friend, the undocumented filmmaker, is free. And I think in this moment, we all as creatives need to understand that our fates are tied with each other, that there is no other here. There's just us. Mm-hmm. And we need to really think of each other that way. And we need to broaden our horizons of who we know and how we know them and the stories that matter to us, and that we need to listen and hear the stories of people that live in our same city that we don't know about. So the future of storytelling is to keep telling the story, to be in community with each other, to tell it face to face like you and I are doing in some ways. And it is important as we become a surveillance state, as this the United States becomes a more surveillance state, that we continue to be in community with each other, to be in places with each other, that we know we can protect each other. And when I protect you, I protect myself. When I tell your story, I tell my story. And I think that we have always, from humanity, we told each other stories to understand each other. Mm-hmm. This is the revolution, and we need to keep doing it.
Wonderfully said. As you know, or maybe you don't know, Farah, Drew and I, our tagline for the Slow Dive is listen, reflect, and connect, because we are all interconnected. So it's like that, you know, we're all on the same like blue marble. Whether or not there's like lines on a map or political differences or ethnic differences, we're all the same. As Pollyanna, as people think, really it's not. We're all interconnected. Everything affects all of us. Final question. What do you want your legacy to be? What do you want to do more of?
At 7, my life started with the power of a story. I want my legacy, but I want my everyday. I am here every day, and I am telling a story every day. Mm-hmm. I'll tell somebody else a story every day to somebody else. That to me is storytelling too. And I want that us to understand and know that being able to see how we tell the story of each other to each other is our ability to stand together in this moment. Our solidarity, it depends on my knowing your story and actually understanding and taking your story with me everywhere I go. My safety depends on you taking my story everywhere. And I think so my hope is that by telling you today this story, that will inspire all of us to keep telling the stories of people we don't know right now. There's mm-hmm. We can't know everybody, and you don't know somebody today that needs your story to be that needs their story to be told. I want us to do that, and I want as many of us to do that, because art in the face of fascism requires that we speak to each other and we tell each other these stories. So if one person here today knows that story matters and that we need to keep telling it, then I am really deeply grateful for this time and our time together.
Thank you, Farah, for such a thought-evoking and heart-centered interview. I'm really inspired by your work and your spirit. You're such a bright light. And I say that because I feel like I could sit here probably the next few hours and just listen to you and all the wonderful insight and wisdom you have. And I think there's a lot of us who are going to take this episode and carry it with us. And hopefully it'll also evoke empathy and action to pay it forward by sharing more stories, especially those of the most vulnerable who don't have the voice. But thank you so much.
There are people who need us. Thank you so much. Thank you. And I feel the same about you. Thank you for doing Slow Dive, for giving us the opportunity to be able, for people like me, to have the opportunity to talk about our work, to be in solidarity with you, because this is the way that we create community. And I'm really grateful for Slow Dive. Thank you for inviting me.
I am Farida. You are listening to Slow Dive. Till next time, please take the time to listen, reflect, and connect.
Thanks for listening to The Slow Dive. Please be sure to subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq and edited by Drew Franzblau. Our theme music is Dive by Ciro.